Institute. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by Johnstone Fine Foods. Buy premium Irish dry-aged beef at johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Okay, welcome to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And coming up on this week's pod, there's nobody in studio with us today. Billy Big Balls here is just back from a wee trip to Champagne, so we're going to have a wee chat about that. We're going to delve into a little bit of our favourites. We're going to dabble into crisps, chocolates, pizza toppings, you name it.
Chinese takeout.
Chinese takeaway, a little taste of what we like, what Gareth likes, what I like. And we'll still do our recipe of the week. It's going to be Côte de Bœuf this week with myself out of the Johnstone Beef Box. We'll have our culinary conundrums, so don't go anywhere. All right, Gareth, so we're going to dabble into some of our favourites. But before we go down that route...
Here I was. He is going to be banging on about the fact now that this lad has been...
I've kind of had...
Notions.
I've had enough of you now at this stage. A couple of months ago, you were rolling around Florida. Then you went to Porto, stuffing your face with port.
Yeah.
You're the only chef that's actually blabbing his way in all these drink trips.
I mean,
as well.
Blabbing your way.
I don't know, man. I don't know. You've nailed it anyways. Fair play to you. Well, you're just back from Champagne. You're on the phone to me last night, sent me a couple of pictures. I was just leaving the K Club and I was, where's this boy? Can he keep up with you?
You know,
Champagne, was it?
I was at the Harvest. I was over there for, Bollinger brought me over for the, me and then some other colleagues.
It was.
To cook grapes, Gary. I was in the
Jacob's
field.
Pick no good to you.
I was in the field snipping the grapes, grafting for the best part of 40 minutes.
Yeah.
But I tell you,
you look like you were stealing something, that picture you sent me.
Exactly. I tell you this much, I have a newfound respect for how much labour goes into champagne. And look, I kind of knew a little bit about it. I've been over for a process called the Von Clare, which is a process where they blend the different champagnes that they have aged to make their champagne, and they taste all the wine really young, so that's also a very interesting process. But this time when I was over there, IE, which is where champagne is, was just a hive of activity. There was vans everywhere, all the fields had people out picking in them. It actually reminded me of years ago I travelled up the east coast of Australia when all the fruit picking was going on.
Is there any co-op stuff going on over there, like, or does champagne or the Bollinger have all the vineyards, or is there little small producers that also are growing in that area that bring their grapes?
Yeah, so all the different vineyards have plots over there, if you like. And the plot that we were actually picking in yesterday was a Bollinger pop, but beside us, Verve Clicquot was there, Moët was lovely on another hill, Krug was just down the valley. Yeah. But to be standing in such history,
the epicenter,
I suppose,
of that.
Yeah, and look, you and I both are banging on about craft and, you know, like, people that are really at the very top of their game. And what I was witnessing over the last couple of days was winemakers at the very, very
That is the creme de la
creme. It's creme de la creme. But look, really, when you see how much labour goes into it, part of being a champagne, right? So you often hear about, you know, there's different types of sparkling wines. We've actually visited one in Italy ourselves.
Yeah, Franciacorta is the Italian version of champagne.
And another wine trip that you made it to that time.
I can't talk there. We went to Italy for
back
lunch.
Back in that box to you. Yeah, exactly. What was really part of champagne is that all the fruit has to be handpicked. So you can't use machinery. And if you use machinery, you won't be certified as a champagne. So, and I wondered about
never
that process.
Knew that.
But one of the challenges they've had over there with this particular harvest is that they had a lot of rain a couple of weeks ago, which put a lot of mildew on the grapes. But this week, I mean, it was 25, 24
and
degrees.
And when it rains in France, it lashes. Like, there's no in between.
Yesterday we were out there and some of the bunches, like half the bunches already dried up and the other half is like full of bursting fruit. So I kind of understand why they're hand picking it. And
And are they leaving that one on then?
When you cut the bunch off, like, you have to snip off the bad stuff, the dehydrated ones. Maybe some of them aren't green, and you know it's not as technical as it just, or it's not as obvious as it just didn't get enough sun.
Is Champagne northern France geographically?
Not sure.
No, you don't.
I was just sitting in a limo going down there.
You really paid attention.
No, but really, as I said to you, what impressed me about that, and then after we picked the grapes, so Bollinger is made with a grape called Pinot Noir, and it's a red grape, so which is, I think, will surprise a lot of people, because you might just automatically assume that red wine is made from red grapes and white wine is made from, that's not the case, right? So how red wine is made is through maceration. They leave the skins in there for longer. So the Pinot Noir grape is pressed and then it's passed away, so the skins are taken away quite quickly and you're left with this. We actually went down to the pressing factory, which is owned by Bollinger, and we got to taste the raw or the unfermented grape juice.
Wow.
Which is really cool. And it kind of, if you close your eyes and someone told you it was apple juice, you would probably feel it.
Is it at that point, do you know, that they distinguish if it's going to be a vintage year or a reserve, or is it after fermentation? Is it? It's at that point, is
so
it?
So they have certain fields where they're called Grand Cru, so they know the grapes are like really high quality. So they would be used for, they won't know every year whether they're going to make
really bottles or whatever.
Yeah. They blend their special cuvée, which is the one that most people will know, but you won't know until they get the grapes and they get the grape juice and they grade it into 1, 2, and 3 or whatever.
Those palates must be incredible that are deciding all that.
I think that they were telling us yesterday, I think there's 7 people that are involved in that process, and like basically 3 of them will check it and then the other 3 will check what they checked and then they'll all sign off. They obviously grade it through a grading system. And then the grape juice goes down to the winery, obviously, and then with Bollinger, it'll go on to oak for a certain amount of time. They put some of it in steel, and then they also press a little bit of Chardonnay as well. So they're the 2 grape varieties really that they use.
Yeah.
Where the day before we were in another champagne house. It's actually our house champagne in the hotel. It's Ayala.
Ayala, yeah. It's beautiful.
But they only ferment in steel, so they don't use any oak. So it's like when I first started,
good enough to drop a few of them bobos in my room. Exactly. It's nice gear though,
because it's beautiful.
It's very, very crisp. It's gorgeous.
And when I first started getting into wine, like I never understood what was being said to me. I could never pick up on the nuances on the bouquet when I was smelling it, and even on the palate. But over time, like in a kitchen, your palate develops. You understand it a little bit more. I mean, what I do have is I'm able to identify flavours from being a chef. But I still maintain you like what you like. So if you like that bottle of wine that you buy in your local supermarket, doesn't matter what price you pay for it, that's what you like. I mean, I sent you a photograph of where we had lunch yesterday, and it was like right in the middle of the vineyards, a table set up for 20 people.
And the day or two before you went there, you were with the young chefs in restaurant last Hall Sunday in Liverpool.
Yeah, last Sunday.
Tough week.
I've had an awful week.
Garrett Mullins.
Yeah. Now, last Sunday, we brought the young chefs across to, we caught a flight last Sunday morning, and we went over to a restaurant, a 2-star Michelin restaurant.
I had a big group in the K Club from Switzerland, Swiss Michelin star chefs.
Oh, was this week, was it?
Yeah, gone by, yeah. So I had to, I knew that was coming up, like, so I didn't.
And here's me sending you all these photographs of on the road.
I didn't even ask Paul for the time off because I knew it was.
How did it go?
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. Look, you're always nervous about cooking for chefs, and especially like the French guys and the Swiss guys. Mm. They're very, if it's not good, they tell you. Mm. And I know that from cooking in France for 5 years. Like a French chef, they won't give you any benefit of the doubt. Like if they don't enjoy dinner, they tell you right there and then. You know what I mean? So look, I secretly was a bit worried, you know what I mean? It was actually a celebration of Irish lamb. It was the Chef's Irish Beef Club and the Chef's Lamb Club, like through Bordbia. A lot of these chefs and high-end chefs that would buy Irish lamb and Irish beef across Europe. Bordbia take them to the farms and the producers in Ireland 3, 4, 5 times a year. But when I cooked in France, and you got to hit a lot of criteria, you got to be invited into it. And I was invited into that organization when I lived and worked in France and Paris. And so I have that connection with Bordbia Paris office, and they tend to look after all of Europe. So these guys in particular were from Switzerland, mostly Michelin star guys out of there, Geneva, Zurich, and then little little small villages. They're all dotted all around the place. But it was amazing. I mean, they were blown away by the K Club because they'd been going here and going there. And we had
all the scenery,
all the sculptures that were there. Gormley's it was the last weekend of the Gormley Art and Sculpture Exhibition as well. So when they landed, they had all the stuff on the ground.
Cool.
And Andy Warhol in the room that they were having dinner was the Andy Warhol room. Banksy was in one of the other rooms where we did oysters, Guinness, and champagne. So it was really, really special. You know what I mean? But yeah, I was a nervous wreck. So that meant I couldn't join you at Restaurant Moor Hall. So that's, again, going back, we've touched on it on the show a couple of times, like the Young Chef of the Year final. Any of the chefs that mentor, there's usually six young chefs that get to the final, yeah, right?
Seven this year.
And a few years ago, Brona was my young sous chef. She made it to the final. And that was the day that we all went to Italy for lunch. We had the 3-star in Bergamo. And then we went to Franciacorta to the winery there to taste it. So tell us about, I saw all the chefs posting about the dinner. It looked incredible.
You see, part of the, like, and this is really where I would much rather hear the conversations about chefs that, like, you know, getting a job as a chef doesn't just mean you're going to be working on sociable hours, doesn't just mean that you're going to be working in this really high-stress environment. It means that you're going to be really educating yourself all the way through your career, you know, and that's what we want to try and instill in the Young Chef competition, that, you know, we start out with about 40 applicants, which are interviewed, as you know. After that interview process, we normally pick around 14 or 16, I call them kids, but 28 years is the cutoff. They're not really kids, but they go on to cook in a semi-final.
And that's why the standard is so incredibly high, because lots of them are at the best restaurants in Ireland.
Yeah,
and
a lot of them
are all under 28. Like, under 28, it's not that young.
No, a lot of them would probably be near, well, some of them would nearly be at sous chef level or even senior sous chef level. So, but then out of that semi-final process, we pick six. This year, there was a bit of a hung vote, so we brought seven. And then just before the final, so the final is in a couple of weeks, where we have the chef is actually coming over from Moor Hall, and another chef from a Michelin star restaurant in the
Mark
UK is
Burchell,
coming over.
Isn't it? Or,
Kenneth Kilrain is coming over as well to help us judge. We try and bring them somewhere to show, give them a little bit of inspiration, but also show them that, you know, choosing this as a profession, it's part of being a chef, going to other chefs' restaurants, like those chefs that come across to you. It's all, you're going to pick up little bits and pieces. So we flew over last Sunday morning, as I said. There was a bus picked us up at the airport. We went down to the restaurant where we sat and had I'd say there was 12 or 13 course, maybe, taste and menu. So the ingredients that are being given to cook in the final. So the semi-final is a mystery basket where the young chefs come in. They don't know what they're going to be cooking. And then they have to cook two courses for us. But for the final, we actually give them the ingredients. And this year they're getting Skegnor duck as the
cork.
Yeah. And they're also getting some heritage beetroots and carrots. So Mark very graciously put those ingredients into a tasting menu that he cooked for us. But the level of service over there, Gary, like the cooking.
I saw the girl doing the bread and butter service.
Unbelievable.
Just bread and butter. Amazing.
But not even, like, I mean, from when we arrived in, they set us down in their little drawing rooms. Our first five courses were in there. So these wonderful little canapes were coming out.
Yeah.
Each one tasting even better than the one before. And then we were brought into the dining room where we went through another six courses, maybe.
Yeah.
They have a little cheese room. I don't know whether you've seen it. So they brought you in the restaurant. There's a little.
I saw the charcuterie room.
That's in That was actually in a different part of the property. But the cheese room is actually in the dining room. So you're invited up. You go in with I think she was the assistant restaurant manager. And she talked us through all the cheeses. And then, so watching the young, I sat with five of the young chefs, watching them soak all of this in. Mm. And like, there was one guy on the table and I was like, how are you feeling about the competition? And he was like, I think I'm the luckiest person in the world. That's what he actually said. And I kind of, but
that's
lovely. It was such a nice moment. And he was like, did I tell you that he was from Wexford? He was like, Wexford, the local radio station had him on and his parents are really happy about the opportunity. And
he's getting a wee taste of what it's like to be Gareth Mullins.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, well, really, like, that's what our job can do. You know, like,
there's me that was chilling with Pat Kenny this morning.
Yeah, exactly. But that's what it does, you know. And it, like, really, that kind of, I don't know what other.
Well, it's the lovely part of the role, you know what I mean? Like, where it's not the coming in every day, looking at your function sheet, looking at your mise en place list, seeing what's coming up that day and the next day, and trying to map out, you know, your time management for the day and when a serve is starting and what's going on and blah, 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 you know what I mean? And you're all the time on the clock, you know what I mean? Like, and as you know, like, a chef's day is very much like the clock is your friend. Yeah, yeah. And you're trying to fit in, like, I got to work on that. I got to get this in the oven first. I got to be ready for service. And it can be frantic. It can be full on. I mean, it's, you know, it's high octane and it's exciting as well. But the likes of that there is when you're at the other side of it and you see, right, well, this is why I worked hard. Like, I've gone through the interview where I'm working. My mentors at work have educated me to the point, and I've been listening. I've got through that interview. I've been in front of the likes of Gareth or Sunil or Ed Cooney or who, Graham Neville, Kevin Thornton, whomever it may have been in the interview process. And now they're kicking on. They're on a flight. They're flying over to Liverpool to a Michelin star launch at 13, 14, 15 courses to see stuff that they've only ever dreamt of seeing. Some of them would be exposed to lots of it. Even if you're cooking it or you're making it, to be a guest is very different.
And really, Mark and his team really made such an effort with them to really talk them through.
Class.
I mean, I'm sure they do that in any way, but it felt to me that they were really... And to see that the competition gets that much respect over in the UK, where there's a massive culinary competition, as you know, over in the UK called the Roux Scholarship.
Oh, yeah.
And it's run by a family called the Roux, for anybody that don't know them. You would see, or you would have seen, if you watch any type of cookery programs, Michel Roux is probably the one that's most prevalent in recent years. But Alain Roux, his cousin, and before Albert, and they were around. But... Mark actually competed in the Roux Scholarship, and he was like, when he heard that Eurotalk wanted to come over and wanted him as a judge, he
would have been over the moon. He probably was. Yeah, because it's a nice nod to him as well. That, I mean, it doesn't matter what age you are or what stage you get, you know what I mean? Like, when you're being asked to do stuff for your peers, it's kind of cool, you know.
Big
what I mean?
Time, it's cool. And what just to round out the point.
I mean, the fact you've never asked me to judge the final is still a sore point. I mean, I don't know what I have to do to get into Gareth's good books. It's just,
you're in the mix now. Let's just say that you're well and truly.
You said that to me last year, boss.
Like, oh, Jesus. It's on record.
I mean,
now.
I'm in a seven-star chateau in Paris and I still didn't qualify. I don't know.
I'm worried you wouldn't come back. But really what it rounds out is that our job is really about constant learning, constantly changing. I know I said a thing earlier on in this series of podcasts, if it's not broke, break it. And really sitting there when you get something to eat that you really, even though you've had lobster before and you've had lemon before and you had whatever else was in it, you're like, I've never had it quite like that before. And like that,
I had that with the risotto in, is it the Dario? What's the name of that gaff we were in the 3-star place in Bergamo that time? Or Dario or something. Yeah, the name always leaves me, which is crazy. But anyway, I'll think of it now in a second. But we ate a course that day down in the, remember the cheese?
The Gorgonzola.
And you made me think about it whenever you started talking about the room that you were in prior to
dinner. They brought us down into their cellar.
We were in the cellar and they did the, was it Gorgonzola or was it a big Parmesan wheel where he cooked the dish in the Parmesan
wheel? He cooked it in the Parmesan, but he also had a Gorgonzola course down there as well.
That's right. And we had a risotto course when we were upstairs. And I'd like to think I'm an aficionado of risotto. Like I really love the skill set involved in a really good risotto. But the one that day in Italy, I mean, look, if you're not gonna get the,
I can see the glint coming across your face even talking about it. And I don't know what other jobs. I mean, I'm sure for a panel beater or a spray painter or anything where there's a bit of craft involved, when you really witness something that's
But that was the year, that was also the year, you know, that Kevin Thornton, they did the mold of Kevin's hand with the whisk.
That's the trophy.
And the Eurotalks Young Chef of the Year trophy is a molding of this hand and a whisk, and it's Kevin Thornton's hand. And I just, whoever thought of that, I don't know if that was you or something, it was Kevin himself. Kevin, that is, it's the coolest. He made it.
He made the trophy. Kevin made the trophy.
You're joking me.
Yeah. Jeez, I need to double check that now because you have me doubt myself. But wow. No, he made the trophy. Because he took
There's no end. You know what? I think you're right. But
he when takes it back every year and he fixes it because when you win the trophy, it goes to your restaurant and it stays in your restaurant for a year. But you know how careful chefs are. So generally speaking, the little spoke on the whisk when it comes out. Or
she gets a few pictures taken with her.
Exactly.
Yeah, like a Champions League trophy.
Exactly. Kevin always takes it back and just tidies it up for us.
Yeah, but you see, the early part of my career, the original Thorntons, I would have been in and around it a lot. I celebrated my 21st, very fancy.
In Thornton?
In Thornton.
Here. You're bleeding slag at me for going to... I went to the Donomede Inn.
I had 21st. I had a bunch of hobos up in Donegal and all my college friends and chef buddies. We went in the beer in Donegal for a weekend. But Garrod Lynch and me and wee Fred and Olivia that owns Dax and Tara that owns the old post with Garrod. All of us crew went to Thornton's for my 21st. I always remember this chocolate Delice cake that with Goldleaf.
Had that actually.
And at the time, Goldleaf was a big thing. And Kevin was nearly the only chef in the country in Gibbs that was using Goldleaf. And he plastered my birthday cake in Goldleaf. And I was like, oh my God, I love Kevin Thornton. He's a legend. And on that trip to Italy, when we were leaving the restaurant to go to Franciacorta, Kevin was telling stories and I was down the back of the minibus and I was between Kevin Thornton and Graham Neville. And I was like, this is the coolest day of all time. Like, and Kevin was telling stories / lies and Graham was rolling his eyes. The crack was...
They worked together for a long time.
I know, yeah. Graham was a sous chef for years. It was just a special day, man. I'll remember it forever. You know what I mean? It was for the young chefs, and I was there as a mentor to Brona, but I was the biggest kid on the bus, man. I was in love in every second of it. It was amazing.
Every time now you try and take a blatant swipe off me for having notions, I'd be like, says your man for his 21st rolling into Thornton's.
Yeah, I always a good taste, you know.
But I mean, again, that comes back to all the people that you mentioned there are all in the trade, so it's
they're the lifers.
Yeah, exactly. And it's you do definitely get to experience the finer things in life. I sent a photograph to my brother yesterday of I was in the vineyard about to sit down for lunch and I tell you what he said, but it's not appropriate for even on a podcast. He sent me back a photograph of a ham sandwich and a computer screen. So he was like, "Would you ever?" Anyway.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by John Stone Beef. Explore delicious recipes and discover their premium selection on johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by John Stone Beef, a tradition of Irish dry-aged beef built on 60 years of passion. Learn more at johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Anyway, with all of that being said, we're going to do a few of our top threes. This is Gary's idea, which I kind of like. So if we were to start it out, Gary, crisps.
Oh yeah.
All chefs love crisps. What's that about?
Don't know. It must be the texture and saltiness.
It's the umami.
Really.
Yeah, exactly. It's the...
it all depends what you're eating,
that's
really, you know.
For MSG, I think that's what
it's definitely a feed of MSG in there somewhere, you know. I suppose my brother being financial controller at Tato, if I was to overlook Tato.
Your brother is the FC of Tato.
Yeah. He's Billy.
Today's a school day for me.
Yeah, he's Billy Big Balls in Tato, so he is, number cruncher. We used to always mess around with Pierce when he was younger. You'd give him maths, we would have a calculator. And Pierce was quicker than we were with a calculator with numbers.
That's just
but he was about 25. He was about 25 before he could tie his shoelaces. Can't score a goal from the 6-yard line. And I think he was 30 before he could drive.
But he's good at keeping score.
He was good with numbers and useless at everything else. You know what I mean? Anytime I see these like bad finishes or Sunday league finishes on Instagram, I say that to him. He was a savage footballer, sweeper. But honest to God, the worst finisher you've ever seen in your life. It's actually a running joke in the family. But yeah, Tato cheese and onion, probably up there as the number one crisp in the world for me.
Mm.
Unrivaled.
They taste like home, don't they?
Oh man, unbelievable. There used to be a gaff in Boston called Kiki's. and now the name of a great restaurant here in Dublin. Eric's Place. But Kiki's in Boston is where you went to buy your Irish gear if you know, you're in the mood for Tato or McDade's football special or banana drink.
I'm charging you lotto numbers for a bag of crisps.
You were paying lotto numbers for Irish bacon and sausages and whatnot, yeah, but you didn't care because, you know, you had the beans anyways. And so, yeah, Tato cheese and onion probably number one. Hunky Dory's salt and vinegar number two. And Hunky Dory's buffalo number three for me. And in any particular order, any given week, I could dabble in all of them, driving up and down.
So you're very much a potato crisp man. You're not going to go near the realm of Monster Munch or any of that mess.
Although I'm partial to chickpea. I'm partial to a porn snack as well, yeah. I'll tell you another cool thing I got to do because of my brother's influence. I got to walk through the Tato factory, the whole process, one day by myself. Took phones and everything. They just about left the belt on my trousers in case I was recording anything. But I got to see how they make the crisps and they make, you know, the rancheros and all the other stuff. It was the coolest. It was like Willy Wonka's factory, man. It was it was amazing, you know. Yeah, loved it. And if you're go snacks like that there, I would say number one, chickadees, number two, rancheros, and number three, wheelies.
Jesus, man, you love the old corn ones.
I do, that's a solid hat trick right there. What about you? What are you eating? I'm going to the gym all the time. I don't like to eat crisps.
No, do you know, I used to have this running joke with my restaurant manager when we first opened the Marker. Like, if we had a bad service, Roderick, his name is, I know he listens, so he'll get a giggle out of this. And he'd be like, chef, I think it's an old gin and tonic kind of bacon hula hoop tonight, isn't it? Or a barbecue hula hoop.
Yeah.
Because I used to be going, Roderick, I'm going to go in now. Normally I'd have a bottle of beer on a Saturday, but I'm going to have a gin and tonic and a bag of hula hoops. And when we were in the middle of it and it was gone.
You've had a nightmare service.
I've had a nightmare. Like, he'd be going, chef, it's a bleeding hula hoop kind of night. You know, you have these little things that go on with somebody. But I'm partial to that barbecue type flavour.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I absolutely love.
I wish I had to run it down, right? Because I was going to say myself, because Betty comes at me with the beefy hula hoops. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's mad, you know?
The other one that I love, right, is when you're on holidays and you've done the Irish one, so I'm not going to say King and the other ones. They're all really good as well. But when you're on holidays and you get those salted Lays.
Yeah.
And like, everyone is still getting ready. You're sitting on the balcony. You can't do it.
Not
and a bottle of the local beer. Whatever,
I don't know what it is about them Lays, man. No, not for me at all.
They always make me feel like I'm on holidays. So
do they? Yeah, but I can get that, yeah.
Yeah, I think
when I lived in America, I missed the Irish crisps, something serious, you know. I mean, look, there's loads of, like, you look at Kuehl's as well and O'Donnell's. They're amazing. Like, they're very fancy-pantsy versions of Tato, I suppose.
We
know.
Use them in there's actually a Guinness one that they do, and we have them in the minibar in the hotel.
There's one with chili as well. Very, very nice. So I suppose if you're feeling like maybe in pay week and you're feeling a wee bit flush, you know what I mean? Or Champions League finals on, you're dabbling in a wee lot of McDonald's. Yeah, like, they've got a cheddar one as well, and an onion that's, oof. And it's, I don't know if it's a different potato or the way they're cooking them, you know what I mean? Like, but they're strong. Like, they're, you feel like you're eating a more pricey spud or something.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? But like,
remember
growing
up, there was those little, or they call them matchsticks or something.
Yeah,
they're really
mini sticks, I think. The wee salt and vinegary ones, they leave your lips white.
They bleed and turn your eyes near you. Like, they're like,
they still do. Would you believe I saw them only about a few weeks ago and I bought a packet?
A bleeding crisp.
Oh, I am.
Oh, man. You've kept quiet.
I only got through half of them, man. The lips were on fire. It's like a salt and vinegar Pringle, too. They can leave your face white.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they're deadly. Moving along, and what's up next? Chocolate bars.
Chocolate bars, yeah.
Ah.
You're another, you like a chocolate bar, don't you?
Listen, man.
I often see you getting an old sneaky chocolate bar when we're doing
this. This is going to be, there's a few different things here. The best dessert that I ever came up with, I'll be talking to Fernando now, my pastry chef in the K Club soon. Sammy, when I was in Viewmount House, we used to make this. So I was eating a Star Bar one night driving home from Viewmount House. And I said, I want a PBJ. I used to love coming up with like old school sherry, like sherry trifles, bringing it back to a menu in a nouvelle way, right? So this one night I'm driving back years and years ago. It was about 2 years before Pollen Street Social opened too, because somebody really annoyed me one time and said, oh, did you get that idea of Jason Athenon? And I went and I sent him a picture of my menu from two years earlier. But it was true. It was the center of a Star Bar was the peanut butter, and I thought like PBJ, peanut butter and jelly. So I gave it to Sammy. She didn't know what a Star Bar was. Sammy was from Latvia, but didn't eat chocolate bars here. And we made a peanut butter parfait. And then in rhubarb season, we enveloped it with a little thin, elegant line of a rhubarb jelly. Then we had a rhubarb teardrop meringue. It had a little coconut sorbet and then different bee pollen and other little bits of funky. Without doubt, the greatest dessert that ever came out of my mind. Sammy made it, but I suppose I was a creativity thinking about it.
Because I've had a Snickers dessert a couple of times.
Yeah.
I think does one, doesn't he? Stephen Apicia, I think, does one.
Does he, yeah.
He does a take on a Snickers, yeah.
Yeah. So Star Bar would be number one for me just because of that texture and the star. And it's got to be eaten from the fridge as well. Essential. Can't eat them soft. Number two would be a Dime Bar. Which you don't see in, there's maybe a different name in them now. I call them a Dime
Bar.
What's
the name
still.
Of the,
is there a different name on it now?
The place where you go and buy cheap furniture, what's it called? IKEA sell them, don't they?
Well, do they?
At the end, you've never had a Dime Bar. Yeah, they sell bags of them.
I get plenty of Dime Bar, so I'm not losing out. And number three actually is a Topic. And there's one that I struggle to find anywhere anymore. The greatest bar of chocolate ever made, you could argue, as a Topic. You can put any of the top three in any particular order, really.
Are you not into just a chocolate bar?
No.
Just chocolate?
Well, if it was just a chocolate bar, it would be a Whisper or a Twirl. Again, must be from the fridge. Like, hard, snappy.
I like a Dairy Milk.
Shocking.
What do you mean shocking?
Not for me.
Dairy Milk in Ireland.
Too gooey, too much chocolate. Good chocolate in a whole nut, world class.
No, I like a Dairy Milk.
On its own. Too much
I actually like dark chocolate. So, like in the supermarket,
Bourneville.
Not Bourneville. No. The Lindt ones are very good, I think, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know what brand it is, but there's one in Lidl and there's a tiny little flake of sea salt in it.
Yeah.
And I quite like it. It's decent enough bar.
Yeah.
And do you know what I actually had? That was ages ago. A Turkish Delight. You remember them?
Shocking.
Yeah, you don't like a Turkish Delight?
Oh my God, the worst.
What's wrong with you, man?
They're a marmite. That is, you either love them or you hate them.
No, I like
Turkish Delight. Actually, I'm getting.
I can see the look.
Now.
I can see the look of disgust
the
in
jelly,
your face.
I never ever liked it. It's like a chocolate orange as well. That's another combination of flavor that blows my mind. Like chocolate orange, shocking. Like the Terry's.
I love a Terry's chocolate orange.
Do you?
From the fridge.
I mean, I love the look of it. I love the presentation of it.
We used to get them. Santi used to leave them in our socks, so it has a little of it.
They're dear, you see. Yeah, Santi's the only man could afford him.
There's a bit of nostalgia kicking on there. So.
Yeah, true. But anything with a nut at all is always good. You know what I mean? Like the El Clasico Snickers bar was deadly. Like Double Decker's another one that's world class. Topics, brilliant again. But the Topic Star Bar. And
you're like the lad now the guest that's in and we ask him for his favourite meal and he gives us
50 courses.
Top three, yeah. You're only giving us about 90 and blading bars of chocolate there.
Yeah. I do have a sweet tooth, man. Yeah, I dabble in a lot of them, you know.
So next we're moving into beer. And I'm going to start off by saying, like, if you don't pick Guinness as your top.
That's a stout, though.
Yeah, but...
I know what you mean.
I don't drink...
You treat it as a beer, pint.
I do, yeah. Like, and I, like, just when you're in somewhere and you get a good pint of Guinness, there's nothing better than a good pint of Guinness. I actually can't drink too many because they make me bleeding too drunk. So I have I can only have...
They go down easy.
I think that's what's wrong. I drink them too fast.
Yeah, you can drink Guinness a lot quicker than a lager. I don't know what it is. You know what I mean? It's smoother or something. Before you know it, you're four or five deep.
And you're in the world of you like an IPA, don't you?
Yeah, I love an IPA. But my favorite beer, bar none. And you used to be able to buy it in Super Value all over Ireland, and then Tesco, I think, used to do them as well. But Sam Adams Boston Lager is hands down.
Yeah, it's brilliant beer.
The most beautiful beer I have ever drank.
There's a beer over in Australia called James Bogue. It's made down in Tasmania. And it was expensive. I used to treat myself to an odd six pack of it, you know, when I was over there. And it's very, very similar to Sam Allen. It's almost the same.
Yeah. And another one I love then would be the Brewdog. And I know your man that owns Brewdog, kind of like he's got, it's very much divides opinion on him, you know what I mean? But they've got the Hazy Jane IPA with a guava flavor, but it's the one that's with a guava flavor. It's not sweet, no. It's almost, it's just got a freshness to it more than a sweetness to it, Gareth. It is phenomenal.
Right.
I used to like the Hazy Jane. I can't actually drink the Hazy Jane now unless it has the guava.
Really?
It is. You've like, I go to Craft Central all the time, like just around the corner.
We spoke about it with Stuart last week.
Around the corner from Marconi House is a little newsagent's, but it's got the absolute best off license in the whole country, but their online presence. Now, lots of the microbreweries would sell into them. So anybody out there that, you know, before you start saying we don't support the microbreweries, these guys are almost a one-stop shop where you can buy from, whether it's Kinnaker or Lochgill or whatever it may be, Wicklow, Whiplash, all of them, it's all in there, craftcentral.ie. No matter where you are in Ireland, for $5, whether it's 2 cans or 202 cans, it's $5 for delivery. It's irrelevant.
Really?
It's the same price for delivery. And go online, and if you order before 11 or 12 o'clock in the morning, and by the way, we have no reason to be giving them the plug other than the fact that they're just brilliant and it's
Stuart
efficient.
Brought in, I think I was telling you last week,
you'll have it the next day.
3 or 4 of them, and he showed them to me, like really cool artwork on the cans.
If you
the flavours, man,
I'll show you that shop someday. That
we're went into it.
We're nearly always rushing back to work, but any brewery in Ireland worth talking about will be in there. They also have stuff from all across Europe. So for me, Sam Adams, number one, Brewdog, Hazy G and Guava would be number two. And then I would throw Guinness in there as well, like you. I mean, I'm anemic. I'm really low on iron all the time. So I take a pint of Guinness. I never really liked Guinness, but going back about 12, 15 years ago, the doctor actually said to me, take a Guinness every evening or every other evening if you can. Just take a pint, literally for medicinal purposes. No joke. Because iron tablets are really,
you know, you're going to have an influx into your Gmail or into your Instagram account now asking you for that doctor's number.
Oh, yeah.
Every man in the country would be like going up to him. So you,
yeah,
I have it right.
Mammy, whenever she was pregnant, when my older brother and me was anemic, and she used to be given a bottle of stout as well, like back then, she was told to drink one every day.
I don't think they'll do that nowadays, will
it? Yeah, well, that's what I do. I take one Guinness maybe every now and again, and I never liked it initially when I started, but it's like anything, you develop a palate for it. But I usually have only a few, and like when I have that, I have one quite often. But if I was going out on a night, I would never have more than 2 or 3. Because like you, I never really feel drunk, don't like that feeling. But when I drink Guinness, or if I look at whiskey, never mind drink it, but if I look at it, my legs start to go wobbly.
You can look up at the top shelf.
And Guinness does the same to me, you know what I mean? But a gorgeous drink in the right pub.
Yeah, I like Peroni as a lager. I'd probably throw that in. I'm not going to go down the microbrewery route. And also this year, for some reason, I've really got into drinking Corona. I don't know why. I think it's just maybe because I've been doing so much cooking in the garden out in the pizza oven, but a cold Corona.
You associate Corona with summer though, don't you?
Oh man, they're just lovely. They're really, really, really crisp or something. Now, I mean, I know they're not massive flavoured beers, and there's loads of Irish craft beers out there that are excellent.
Yeah.
But the mainstream stuff, that's where I'm at. So what else did we say we'd cover? Wine. Are we going to do wine?
Wine, yeah. Maybe pizza toppings, another one, and then we can move on from there. Yeah, so wine for me, number one, Montrachet all the way. I absolutely would drink it out of a dirty sock. It's just beautiful.
Do you know what I love about wine? Like there's so many places to go with wine, and it changes so much.
Well, with wine, when it comes to myself, you know, I'll drink white for years and red for years. Like I haven't drank red for a lifetime, you know what I mean? And I never ever used to touch white. It's just white nowadays. I just the way I like it.
So now drink wine?
Yeah, now and again, yeah. She'll drink, like, she loves a white one, you know what I mean? But we do have different palates when it comes to what she likes. But for me, I love the minerality, like dry, you know what I mean? Like a Chablis, Montrachet for me. Like,
well, I'm going to give you grapes that I like. Yeah. So I love a Chablis.
Yeah.
I love a Pinot Noir. And I sound really blatant stupid saying this, but I actually love champagne.
Oh yeah, well, hey, meet your brother. I mean,
I'd say people are like, oh, Jesse used to play like him, man. What's he shouting about? Yeah. He loves champagne. No, just, and now that I know
me from the back end of Donegal, you drag through Don and Maiden, yeah, two boys balling with champagne. But we're always standing with the champagne flutes on our nights out, aren't we? But it's just gorgeous, man.
Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah. And out of the champagnes, and I know you're a Bali man, like you do, like, I'm quite partial to Ballinger as well. Moët, love it. Probably if I was go 1, 2, 3, be Moët, Ballinger, and then Viv, you know what I mean? In that order, top drawer, just gorgeous.
Yeah, very, very good. I've been lucky enough to taste some really high-end champagnes just with work, but Krug is very, very good, I suppose. So if you're asking me to pick something, you're looking at me going, this fella having a laugh. But I'm gonna leave Bolly and Ella there because they've taken such good care of me over the last couple of days. So I'll leave the love there.
We nod to them. We'll do pizzas and then quickly and we'll move on. Are you going pineapple or not?
Oh, I gotta know. Way am I going
good
pineapple.
Man. You would have let me down there.
Jesus Christ, man. Pineapple?
You would have let me down a bag.
Never.
It's all about the barbecue base for me. I love a barbecue base pizza, right? Chicken, sweet corn, onions, peppers. Giddy up.
Yeah. Pizza, like, there's so many different routes you can go, but if you get a really, really well, it's about the crust. It's really about a really great crust. I like a margarita, like good mozzarella, good basil, nice olive oil. Mm. It's perfect for me. I like pizzas that are finished sometimes with a little bit of like blue cheese or,
yeah.
I had a potato, rosemary and gorgonzola pizza when I was in Rome. And I can still taste the wood it was.
I have a fig one I do. It's a little like fig jam. It's a fig base, okay? And then it's got pan-roasted a brunoise of butternut squash with thyme.
And a pizza.
Yeah, cashel blue. Used to be Crozier blue. Cashel blue cheese crumbled on it. And Serrano ham and prosciutto, a little bit of each for saltiness.
And cooked then, or raw after?
No, it's all cooked. So the butternut squash, I cook it with a little bit of butter, olive oil, and fresh thyme. Set it aside. So it's just a light thing of fig jam on the base. Don't go overboard on the fig jam. So it's almost blonde, like it's almost white, like with dotted bits of this fig jam that I make. Then sprinkling over the butternut squash. Then loads of aged Parmesan. The cashew blue cheese, Serrano ham, prosciutto in the oven, comes out, and then I sprinkle it with arugula or rocket leaf and then cut it up and eat it. And it is special, mate. I used to do it as a little flatbread on a nighttime menu when I was in Boston. We had a cocktail lounge and I had it as a little flatbread, but also translates really well into a high-end fancy-pantsy pizza.
Cool. All right. Well, look, that's a bit of crack. Loads for people to take in there in the world of chefs.
And they can send in to food@goloudnow.com their own favourites.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Okay, Gary. So this week we've got our culinary conundrum. So the first question that came in here is, hi, Gareth and Gary. Big fans of the pod up here in Letterkenny. And great to hear the Donegal twang every week. I'm glad someone likes hearing the Donegal. I plan to lady listen to two years there last week. I always struggle with side orders for steak. What would you recommend that pairs well without overshadowing the main event?
Well, for me,
Sammy,
you've got to have crispy onions, or as we say in Donegal, tobacco onions, right? So basically, what you want to do is take a big, large Spanish onion and shave it as thin as possible. We talked about the mandolin, Gareth, there a few weeks ago. You got to use a mandolin for this here, right? Because the knife, you have to get them wafer thin, right? And when you slice a large Spanish onion, like literally where you can see through it wafer thin, put it out onto a roasting tray. Leave it for about 15 minutes. You'll start to see this milky hue will appear on the onion. Once you start seeing the juice now engulf all the onions, it takes about 10-15 minutes for it to come out of the pores. 170 degrees deep fat fryer on. Have your flour with some smoked paprika, regular paprika, salt and white pepper, and even cracked black pepper in the flour. Overly season your flour. Run those onions straight into it. Don't put them into milk or anything else. Just straight into the flour and then fry them. And the flour will stick to that milk and they'll come up absolutely perfect. And it'll be almost like these strands.
Did you learn how to do them in America? Because I've had them in New York steakhouses, and Shanahan's do them, I think, don't they?
Yeah, they do, actually, yeah. I would have learned to do them, actually, up in Donegal. Because
really?
The Nordies, whenever they're coming up to Downings, when I worked in the Rosapenna, whether it's a culture up in the north where they love these things, they call them the tobacco onion, they would be coming in the summers up there. You'd be full of people from Derry, Belfast, and beyond. And I just always made them. Like, it was just always seemed to be on a menu when I was training. And they're absolutely beautiful with a steak. And because, like, you know, that they're never going to overpower. And again, I'm kind of old school there. Like, even like a lovely sautéed mushroom finished with butter and freshly chopped parsley is absolutely gorgeous.
Do you know what I love with a steak is a spinach salad, a baby spinach salad.
Yeah.
I like the way the bitterness of the leaves just kind of cook back across the fat of the beef. So, and that's as simple as baby spinach dressed in a little bit of olive oil, some either lemon juice or some balsamic vinegar and some salt. That's it. Like, I think most steakhouses will have a green salad on the menu, and that's why. Because you're normally having chips or onions or mushrooms with it.
You'll see as well a lot of the times, like a mac and cheese, you know what I mean? But for me, as beautiful as it is, if macaroni and cheese is made well with a really good, rich, like, array of cheeses, it's nearly too strong for the steak.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? So, good one. All right. Question two. Hey, Gary and Gareth, every time I try to caramelize onions, they either burn or take forever. What is the best method to get that rich, sweet flavor without turning them into a charred mess? And that's from Deirdre Foley in Nice.
Good question, Deirdre. But I'd say the problem is you're just trying to go too hot and too hard at the start. Caramelized onions really just take time. And I think it's the one thing people try and rush. And you're probably not putting enough oil in at the start, you know, like you probably need to put too much oil in, and then you can just use a spoon to take the oil away at the end, because oil is what conducts the heat and what actually lets them fry. And then just start them off like at a medium to high heat, and then once you feel they're starting to catch a little bit, lower the temperature down a little bit and continue to fry them. And then if you want to turn them into like an onion jam or an onion relish, you're going to add in some type of alcohol, either some port or some Madeira or even some white wine. That'll help it not stick as well. But that's it, really. I'd say you're just going too aggressive with it. It's just too much heat. That's why it's catching on you. It's that simple. It's not a difficult thing to do.
All right.
Yeah, any tips for Cara? That's more or less it.
Yeah, for me, look, yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, the only way they're burning is you're just cooking them fire too high. You know,
or there's not enough oil in.
Listen, when it comes to Lyonnaise onions, don't make them if you're in a hurry. It just cannot. It's one of those things that just cannot be made in a hurry. It's got to be slow, and you've got to be left on a low part of the stove for a lifetime. Yeah. You know what I mean? You're just not going
to... If you want to lift your caramelized onion game, I would suggest using a couple of different types of onions, like using some white onion, bit of red onion, even some shallot, and it'll just give more texture and more, especially if you put the shallots in, it'll give more sweetness.
Don't forget vinegar and sugar.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, exactly. Like whenever they're cooked down and they're almost starting to soften, feed in with a little cider vinegar. I love to use a little red wine vinegar, actually. And then whenever you put in vinegar, we always say, and then you got to hit it with a little bit of sugar, and then let that cook. That'll help with the caramelization as well. That sweet, sour, gives you that real unique flavor at the end. But just patience is your key when it comes to Lyonnaise.
Okay, another question coming in there. Gary and Gareth, love the pod, especially your advice on gadgets. My kids are calling me Inspector Gadget as I keep buying them. I keep hearing about microplanes. Are they really a game changer in the kitchen? And if so, what's the best way to use them?
Yeah, look,
I mean, they're a new enough phenomenon. I don't remember microplanes when I started in kitchens. Like, it's only that brand, I think, is only kicking around the last 10 years or so. But I mean, now they're used all the time, for like grating, you know, nutmeg or grating. Like, I think you shared a tonka bean recipe here a few weeks ago. Any like hard spice that you can hold in your
hand, nutmeg in particular, yeah, is really good with it.
Obviously, cheese,
Parmesan's the one that mine tends to be. I've got one, right? And whether this is chef OCD or not, I don't know, but Are you particular about how the cheese falls after it comes out of a microplane? Like some of the microplanes, whenever you grate it, they don't keep the strands together. They kind of just come out in bitty,
bitty bits.
Yeah. The cheese, if the cheese isn't falling absolutely perfect for me, like and almost engulfing whatever I'm grating it over, it just...
But what I would say is that they sell ones that are like an inch thick. I normally stay away from them ones. Try and buy the one that's a little bit wider. It's like 2 or 3 inches.
Mine is that one that you're saying. Yeah,
the little skinny one.
The one I like. Yeah, the little skinny one. Yeah, because you can use it rapid. You know, well, I say use it rapid, but like a grater, they're a chef's biggest nightmare. I mean, like the chances, we'll never cut our hands with knives, but graters, microplanes.
And they're really sharp.
They're a disaster.
Yeah, but they're good for grating, like even garlic or ginger or like they really, anything you would use a grater for, you can use a microplane for, except it just gets you a much finer product on the other side.
Yeah, so if you're adding parmesan to a pasta dish to finish it, if you're putting it in a grater, it's just taking longer to melt the cheese. Yeah, yeah. The benefit of the microplane is it gets it fine. You melt it, you emulsify it a lot quicker. Then if you're also like finishing a dish with a wee bit of cheese, like you just want that elegance that a microplane gives you. Look. A grater does the same thing, but really it's in the eye of the beholder, really, you know what I mean? So
they're not that expensive, so they're definitely worth if you're talking. Say, just buy one. Go deep.
You madman.
Okay, so that's all the culinary conundrums for this week. So as always, send them into us or even send them into myself, Gar Mullins, on Instagram or Gaza Chef, because that's also a good way of getting a hold of us. Okay, Gary, so that is us for another week. Good show today. I mean, it's nice to change the pace on it a little bit.
Yeah.
Found out a few bits about you today, I have to say. I would have known you were a crisp fan, but Jesus, man, you're really into it, aren't you?
I'm an aficionado, mate. There's nothing I don't know about spuds.
And look, thanks as always to Johnstone Beef. And look, they're still selling the steak boxes and the roast boxes. And if you haven't tried it, they really are top grade.
And it just reminds me I didn't do a recipe of the week, but sure, look, it's grand. I was going to do Cote de Boeuf, but we've done it anyways.
Yeah, well look, we've done the ribeye, and come here, look, we gave you a couple of recipes there for the caramelised onions, which would be brief and perfect for a Cote de Boeuf.
Yeah,
and you know, those crispy onions to me are, they're probably the best thing you can
have. The crispy, bang on, really. The only thing with a Cote de Boeuf, right, real quick, over salted with flaky mould and salt, sear it all the way around, preheat the oven to 180, 17 minutes at 180, rest it for 8 minutes, covered in foil, slice it against the grain, and serve it with our Lyonnaise onions and our tobacco onions.
So I know he said he wasn't going to do a recipe, but there you go.
There you go. Now you know how to make it.
Gary, and look, come here, when you are going onto the website, don't forget to use the discount code. Yeah. It's
JSBDO.
And I'm laughing because every week I go to say that code, Gary almost has it from me because I always forget it. So look, thanks a million as always to our sponsors. And look, tune in next week and we'll have a guest back with us next week.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by Johnstone Fine Foods. Get premium Irish dry aged beef delivered to your home at johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.